The Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Fraser.
Present.
Lee Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Representative Long. Representative Long. Representative Lucero.
Happy Thursday afternoon.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Representative Botany.
Botany, present.
Representative O'Neill.
Neil, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Shung.
Present.
Representative Long. Chair, that concludes roll call. A quorum is present.
Very well. With a quorum present, this hearing is conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, safe staff and members. This hearing is live streamed on the House website and can be accessed via the committee page. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact via email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamal Lundy, 24 hours prior to a hearing. Email address is also available on the House committee webpage. Members, today, let me just make sure we're taking care of the minutes here. Representative Feist, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of March 29th? I think I caught her off guard.
I can move the minutes.
Very well. Representative Hollins moves adoption of the minutes of March 29th. Discussion. Lee Johnson, we're okay with a voice vote?
Voice vote is fine.
Very well. All in favor of adopting the minutes of March 29th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 29th are adopted. Members, we're not going to move any bills today. It's not my intent. My intent is for us to have a good, healthy conversation on two very important issues. I've allotted 20 minutes for the presentation of both of these, as well as 25 minutes for public testimony and member questions. So my hope is that we'll do what this committee does best, which is to engage with one another with good comments and thoughts and questions. I will probably have to interrupt folks if they begin to push my best laid plans to make sure we have a good, healthy discussion on both. So I'm gonna apologize to everyone ahead of time if that's the case. So we're gonna be hearing a presentation of the Wilder Foundation's external review of the state's response to last summer's civil unrest. We're gonna do that first. And then following that, we're gonna have an informational hearing on House File 4609, Chair Moran. This is a Corrections Supervision Standards Committee created, probation funding and supervision funding provided. And again, we will not be acting on that bill today. So with that, let's begin with the presentation of the Wilder report.
And Chair Mariani?
Yes, Lee Johnson, please.
Well, before we get started, I was just inquiring. There's been a number of committees that are now meeting in person. I'm just wondering if there's any, if you've looked into doing that for next week at all. I think it'd be good for all the members of this committee to actually get together at least once this biennium. So we have better understanding and actually have an opportunity to meet and greet each other in person. I think it'd be important for that. And for those, anybody in the SOB right now, we do have room 200 open for those willing to come down and just sit, and so we can discuss things as well while we listen to the presentation.
I'll seriously take that under advisement. Thank you, Lee Johnson. I appreciate it. We'll begin with the Wilder External Review of the state's response to last summer's civil unrest. And we'll begin with testimony from Anna Granias, research scientist at the Wilder Research Foundation. Ms. Granias, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee for inviting me here today. My name is Anna Granias, and I am a research scientist at Wilder Research, which is part of the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation. We are a research and evaluation group located in St. Paul with a mission to improve the lives of individuals, families, and communities. And I'm also joined by my colleague, Nicole Martin Rogers, and our law enforcement consultant, Jose Vega, who are here to help answer questions after my comments. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety contracted with Wilder in February 2021 to conduct an external review of the state's response to the civil unrest that followed the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer in May 2020. And I've been asked to present information about the report that was developed for DPS and was just released today. So thank you to Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn and the other state staff who assisted in the completion of this project, and to the Minnesota Justice Research Center for your partnership. Before I jump into the presentation, I want to acknowledge that what happened during the period under review was unexpected and unprecedented. There's some degree of trauma that we all experienced during this period, and as a result of having lived through it, I myself was living in South Minneapolis as a new mom, watching it unfold on my television with my windows closed to keep the smoke out of my home. So that's just all to say it has been a personal and professional privilege to have been involved in work that has such potential to minimize the impact of civil unrest and substantially improve the preparedness of state and local agencies to manage mass demonstrations safely. So I'll cover the following agenda items over the next 15 to 20 minutes. The report includes 20 recommendations, and I'll just highlight a few of them here today, particularly those that may have policy implications. So the purpose of this review was threefold: to objectively evaluate what the state did well and did not do well, to identify actions and options that may have produced different or possibly better outcomes, and to provide recommendations to the Commissioner of Public Safety to assist state and local governmental units, including cities and counties, in responding effectively to potential periods of regional or statewide civil unrest in the future. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our methods. We used a variety of methods and data sources for this review. First, we conducted a literature review to recommend best practices for preventing and responding to civil disturbances. Our team reviewed research studies that extended across multiple disciplines, subject areas, and methodologies. We also reviewed relevant media articles published from the period under review, May 26th to June 7th, 2020. And the information gathered from the media review was used to build a timeline of events during the period of interest, identify key decisions and actions and communications from the state, and to understand what and how events had an impact on community members, including business owners. And this step also served as a check against other information and data collected to ensure the timeline is accurate and that the most salient actions taken by the state were explored in subsequent data collection activities. We also reviewed state documentation provided by DPS. Most importantly, this included a detailed timeline developed internally by DPS, their internal after-action review, and details regarding communications activities. A critical component of the data collection for this project was interviews with 58 people. We compiled a sample list in collaboration with our subcontractor, the Minnesota Justice Research Center, with DPS and through referrals from those we interviewed. And our aim was to hear from a wide variety of people at both the local and state government level, elected officials, as well as outside of government at the community level. We conducted 8 focus groups with community leaders, some of whom were youth and local business owners in the areas directly affected by the unrest. And we used a targeted recruitment approach led by the Minnesota Justice Research Center. They were also the ones to facilitate these discussions with Wilder staff members taking notes. And lastly, we worked closely with a nationally recognized law enforcement expert, Jose Vega, who now trains agencies nationally after working in crowd control for NYPD for many years. He reviewed the report several times, actually, and provided feedback on the findings and recommendations. So more detailed information about all of these components and our methods is available in the full report. There are a few limitations worth noting. So the original timeframe allowed for this review was tight, requiring Wilder to conduct some data collection activities and analysis concurrently that we would have ideally conducted sequentially. However, ultimately, we were provided more time to conduct additional data collection and to work with an external law enforcement expert, as well as with experts within DPS to ensure the comprehensiveness of the review. There may be missing perspectives. Studies always have some limitations due to the time and resources and the willingness of people to participate. Luckily, through our partnership with MNJRC, and I believe our reputation at Wilder Research, we were able to get what we feel was good participation from critical city officials and community members most affected. Oops. Lastly, the period in which we were gathering data was unique. The pandemic had just begun when the civil unrest occurred and was in full swing during our data collection period. Also, a police officer in Brooklyn Center killed another Black man, Dante Wright, one day before focus groups for this project began. And the trial of Derek Chauvin was also happening during this period. So all of these external events may have affected how people showed up and responded to our questions about the specific time period we were reviewing. But despite these challenges, we felt we were able to refocus participants to recall the period under review. So although some of the study's recommendations rely on the participation of multiple entities, these are really the key overarching recommendations for the state to consider as a main actor. But now let's delve a little deeper into some specifics. And as I mentioned, I'll highlight some of the recommendations that we feel may be of most relevance to this committee. So one of the main recommendations is to strengthen multi-agency coordination. Knowing what we know now about the potential scale of coordination needed from state and local jurisdictions, much of this is about preparation. We know from best practices in the literature that operating within a defined and unified management structure is essential to facilitating a well-coordinated multi-agency response. And to allow time to work out any glitches in the setup and interoperability of the multi-agency command structure, we recommend DPS be involved in a unified command structure like the multi-agency command center that was set up in this instance. Or DPS should set one up if they are the jurisdictional lead, anytime there's a strong likelihood of civil unrest occurring, and when it is anticipated that state resources may be needed. Early setup and participation also helps with resource allocation and prevents duplication of services. While DPS did set up a multi-agency command center, also known as the MAC, during the civil unrest under review, Our review found that there was a chaotic beginning and differing reports regarding the extent to which a chain of command was understood and followed. Initially, in this instance, the lack of clarity among participating agencies regarding chain of command and the unified command structure hindered effective and timely response to the unrest. While the state has no authority to compel local law enforcement agencies into unified command, the state could play a role in bringing these parties together in advance and could communicate with these agencies regarding the benefits of coordinated planning. So participation in a National Incident Management System or NIMS training and Incident Command System or ICS training would benefit all entities that are responsible for responding to civil unrest in Minnesota. And funding and support from the legislature or other sources may be needed to facilitate these types of coordinated efforts. So we heard multiple times throughout this review that prior relationships go a long way in facilitating efficiency and ability to work together during crisis situations. Multi-agency emergency response training and mutual aid training are key ways to promote this relationship building and to ensure systems are not only in place, but are practiced and familiar to the key staff within each agency so that these systems can really be relied upon and effectively implemented when unexpected events of this magnitude arise. And the crowd management law enforcement expert who consulted on this project, Jose Vega, is here today if you have follow-up questions about these types of trainings that I mentioned. So there was a significant number of law enforcement agencies involved in the response. It was evident and problematic that each agency was using their own policies and procedures. We know that from the research literature that inconsistent tactics may compromise the operation of another agency, jeopardize the safety of responding personnel, and damage interagency trust. And, you know, quote unquote, anything goes approach and mentality in response to civil unrest must be avoided regardless of the circumstances. Furthermore, when different law enforcement teams use uncoordinated and varying tactics, it negatively affects the morale of law enforcement professionals and can potentially incite more frustration among the people who are protesting if they feel the tactics being used by law enforcement are inconsistent, unclear, and potentially in violation of their rights to peacefully protest. So this was a serious problem. For example, there were accounts of the Minnesota State Patrol using contain and arrest tactics while the Minneapolis Police Department was simultaneously using crowd dispersal tactics. Other policy and practice issues to consider include the thorough and consistent tracking of the use of less lethal munitions, which leads to more accountability and judicious use of those munitions. And this was not done consistently across agencies during the civil unrest under review. As much as possible, local, state, and federal agencies should adhere to the same policies and procedures when responding to civil disturbances. And guidelines for crowd management and control should be well-defined and adhered to by those responding. And national standards do exist for public order units, formations, and mass arrests. Additionally, there are Supreme Court rulings that clarify rules for when to engage and not to engage in certain tactics regarding crowd control situations. We understand DPS only has the authority it is provided in state statute, and it can only use its appropriations for the purposes provided by the Minnesota legislature. Therefore, we recommend that the legislature determine the role of DPS in working with the post board to make progress toward the development and implementation of statewide standards for crowd management and use of force. So here's a quote that acknowledges this issue as needing a statewide solution. And this is not an easy task by any means. We acknowledge that standards should provide a guide and not be overly prescriptive to the point of agencies not being receptive to them. In addition to paying attention to standards, law enforcement agencies must follow practices that reflect the values of the community they serve. Now, this recommendation may not have policy implications. However, there are pretty clear action steps for improving this process of requesting National Guard assistance in the future. During the civil unrest, there was a clear lack of understanding among City of Minneapolis officials and a communication breakdown between the city and the state in the request for the deployment of the Minnesota National Guard. While officials from the City of Minneapolis did not understand and follow necessary steps, the state did not communicate effectively about the status of the request or what was needed to move forward with the deployment of troops. So moving forward, local jurisdictions need support for developing actionable requests and understanding systems for requesting the National Guard that go beyond what is currently stated in the Minnesota Emergency Operations Plan or the MEOP, as the information there is just not sufficient or detailed enough. Again, mutual aid training would be an appropriate avenue for communicating information about how to request assistance from state law enforcement agencies. To maintain operational control and system discipline, the state should update the MEOP to require that the request for the Minnesota Guard come through emergency management channels for evaluation, processing, recommendation, and action. And this is in contrast to what happened during the civil unrest under review here, where it appears that much of the communication was between elected officials as opposed to solely the emergency management experts. So this recommendation is restated here in this quote, and our review would just add to not only improve the process, but also to improve the training and supports for understanding across local jurisdictions, as well as clear communication and responsiveness from those at the state responsible for facilitating National Guard deployment. Now I'm going to transition to some recommendations that go beyond the original scope of this review, but that were elevated as issues and recommendations related to prevention, preparation, and recovery deemed equally important. Many of the community members and business owners who participated in this review talked about racism and discrimination against Black Minneapolis residents as a key contributing factor to the unrest. Many respondents recommended that the state should prioritize policing reform or transformation, noting that police violence is not limited to Minneapolis. Efforts at the state level to reimagine policing and community safety and ensuring that communities play an active role in shaping policing policies and practices will build much needed police trust and legitimacy. Other considerations noted in our review include exploring DPS's role in influencing local law enforcement agencies to establish community review boards and oversight committees, and to consider the development of a state-level community review board. Also to consider their role in tracking and reporting data on excessive use of force and instances of misconduct by local and state law enforcement personnel. The research literature shows that a lack of data presents barriers to making policy change in use of force tactics. Capturing and using excessive use of force data can also help establish a culture of transparency and accountability, which may improve police legitimacy and community police interactions. So this is my last recommendation. This is a quote here, but the last recommendation I want to touch on today is on the follow-up from government entities. Community members and business owners felt the follow-up really to be lacking. Business owners talked about visits after the civil unrest from elected officials that were perceived to primarily serve as a symbolic rather than a substantive or meaningful visit. The experience of community members after events of unrest can either help or hinder trust between state government and residents. So kind of at the high level, we recommend that the state more deeply engage with businesses and communities affected by this instance of civil unrest, as well as those communities that face the most risk of potential future unrest. So that concludes my comments. Thank you, Chair Mariani and committee members for this opportunity. I'm available for questions along with my colleague, Dr. Nicole Martin Rogers, and our law enforcement consultant, Jose Vega. Mr. Chair, I yield my time.
Thank you, Ms. Gradius, for your testimony. It's a big report. I started reading through it this morning, and I still need to get through, but thank you for highlighting some of the most salient issues for us. Next, we're going to hear from the Commissioner of Public Safety, Commissioner Harrington, and then we'll open this up for conversation, which may also involve your colleagues, Dr. Martin Rogers and Mr. Jose Vega. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is John Harrington. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I want to thank you for inviting me to participate today. And I also want to thank Wilder and Justin Terrell from JRC for doing the report. I have had a long history from Wilder back when I actually officed out of their home campus when I was a young St. Paul cop. And they have an outstanding reputation for being one of the great research organizations, and really, both they and Justin Terrell were both deeply embedded in community, and that was part of why we were very happy that they were one of the groups that responded to our RFP and asked to do the report itself. So I'll start very quickly by saying that those who don't learn from history are forced to repeat it. It's a quote from George Santayana that I've lived by for a number of years, and I will tell you that the Minneapolis and St. Paul protests and riots, and I differentiate the two because we saw literally thousands and thousands of people out there that were civilly and peacefully protesting, who were truly in angst over the death of George Floyd. But we also saw criminal elements who were there to loot, to commit arson, and to commit mayhem that I do not really believe were part and parcel of the protest groups, but they were there in combination, and it was a challenge to try and differentiate between the one and the other. This is something I have not seen in my 40 plus years of policing. I've been involved with riots or with protests, frankly, since I started in St. Paul in 1977 with the Rolling Stones riot, but the KKK rally at the state capitol, and then later as a chief of the RNC, Justice for Jamar, Philando Castillo protests, Black Lives Matter protests, and other protests and other major rallies have been part and parcel of the work I've done since 1977. Having said all that, the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd, which sparked local, state, U.S., national, and international protests on May 25th, was different. It was fundamentally different. Part of what made it different, and I appreciate Wilder's noting this, is it was unprecedented in terms of the size. I've seen protests that gathered a few thousand people, but I've never seen 10,000 people out on the streets with a common cause. That's something it's beyond my capacity or beyond my vision. It was also unplanned. And historically, the protests and the things that we've dealt with, that we've been able to manage, have been planned protests that were well thought out, whether it was the RNC, where they told us a year and a half before it was going to happen, they gave us $50 million to have the resources. We could coordinate and plan for that. This came up, and the last piece I'll note is that protests are historically matters for the local police department and the local community to manage. A protest in St. Paul was a St. Paul police response and maybe a St. Paul fire response, but it certainly wouldn't have been a Minneapolis response or a Olmsted County response or a Duluth response. This protest was different in that in order to manage the protest, by the time that the state stepped in, we had to recruit well in excess of 80 different other agencies to come together to try and manage what was going on. We mobilized what I think is still accurate, was the largest police and National Guard team that has ever been seen in the state of Minnesota. One of the other things that I will note, beyond the fact that while this was local, it wasn't local. It was localized in Minneapolis, except that it suddenly went from the area where George Floyd was killed and where the officers worked to downtown Minneapolis, to the north side of Minneapolis, to the U of M, to St. Paul, to the Midway area, to Sunray, and places that did not seem to have any local connection to the angst or the anger that was being demonstrated. And so as we were looking at this as a peace officer, we looked at it as if this was going to be a Minneapolis-centric event, and ultimately was bigger than Minneapolis by a long suit. So in very short order, we had to mobilize, and this is the first time it's ever happened, I hope it's the last time it ever has to happen, we mobilized the entire Minnesota State Patrol and brought them to the Twin Cities to respond. We have never stripped the highways of every state trooper before, but we did that. And I was blessed to have had a colonel who had the foresight to have his entire team trained by experts on mobile field force responses. While that was a critical skill and that we had equipment for them and that the DNR joined us in that, it turned out that mobile field force, while it is a national model, has real limitations or had major limitations in application here. Once the state stepped in, and so there is a timeline here that I think that is in the report, and I appreciate the report. It outlines that from May 25th, when George Floyd was murdered, we had a few days, and then on May 28th, we finally got the request. And I echo Anna's comment about the need for clarity from elected officials about what they are asking for, how they're asking. That is part of the ICS training, but frankly, in my conversations with many elected officials, I find that almost none of them have attended the training. And so one of the things that you will see is a proposal for a new modified training that will be more responsive to elected officials so that they will understand when there's a crisis, when there's an emergency, what can the guard do, what can local police do, and what does mutual aid really look like? There was an impression that I got that people thought that the National Guard were like cops and that you could just send them in there and that they would in fact affect arrest. The National Guard are not police officers. They have no police powers and they're not trained as cops. And so that was a misunderstanding by some and one that we had to correct as we were addressing some of the missions that they asked us to bring in. On Friday, so the ask was made on the 28th. By Friday the 29th, we stood up a MAC, a multi-agency coordinating center. I want you to know that that is the first time, and frankly, as far as I know, the only time that a MAC has been stood up in less than 24 hours. This needed to be a space where we would have room for 300 to 400 staff to have computers, to have phone lines, to have parking, to have logistics. And we were able to find the space, open the space, and bring people in the space. Now, one of the challenges of this was that not everybody was operating under the unified command that ICS dictates. And we had other groups that were, in fact, operating on their own unified command or their own incident command. And so there was a fracture between that. And as Anna has mentioned, we don't have the authority to compel other local jurisdictions to join us. We simply ask and beg and plead sometimes. And we eventually get cooperation, but we lose time when we don't have everybody on the same page. I want to comment that Booker Hodges was the assistant commissioner who pulled that together and ran the MAC for us from Friday the 29th through, I think it was June 10th. And that by Saturday, we were seeing success. Whereas the first 3 days, we had not seen much success. By Thursday night, late, early Friday, with curfews and coordinated responses and a much more agile response, we began seeing some success and the fires seemed to stop and the looting seemed to stop. And by Sunday, the looting and the fires had stopped pretty much completely. I will highlight two last quick points because I know my time is short. First, we were blessed at that moment. The state of Minnesota, we put out a call for mutual aid help. And as I said, over 80 local, federal, and county units of government responded to our request for assistance. That is both the blessing and the challenge, because we hadn't trained with those 80 different groups. We hadn't coordinated with those groups. In fact, many of those groups had probably never thought they were ever going to see the city of St. Paul, or the city of Minneapolis in an emergency, but they came. And we are very, very grateful to the men and women of law enforcement and fire and emergency management and EMS who all showed up and strapped it on and helped us try and restore the peace there. Once the MAC was set up, we began utilizing the mobile field force tactics that we had been trained in, and we discovered that a slow, large complement of officers was not effective in responding to fast, small groups that were setting fires, pulling on fences, breaking windows, and then running into neighborhoods that, frankly, the Minnesota State Patrol, the DNR, and our out-of-town visitors were not familiar with. If you can imagine running into the dark, into a neighborhood, and not knowing what fence you're about to run into, it is very definitely a challenge. But with that enhanced coordination and with the National Guard's help, we were able to restore order. Secondly, I'd say this event was different in one of the tactics that I had never really seen used in this way, and that was the tactic of using fire. During the RNC, we saw lots of really interesting things done towards cops, but we saw very little other than some broken windows directed toward local businesses. The use of fire, the providing of literally caches of flammable liquids hidden in neighborhoods, the use of fires that really did appear to us to be a distraction as they would set fire to a auto parts store that had lots of flammables in it. When we then respond to that store a mile away, a pawn shop or a liquor store would then be looted while we were all tied up in one area during the early days of the incident. So we think that is unique and something that, frankly, I'm very fortunate to have the state fire marshal who pulled together ATF and others. We have ended up making over a dozen arrests on the arsonists who used fire, including the individuals who set fire to the Gorton Park School in the Midway area of St. Paul. In my mind, it always bugs the question, what did the Gorton Park School, a school named after a Black man who had done great work in the Twin Cities, what did burning that school have to do with George Floyd? So finally, I'll just get closing with Wilder. I mentioned their long reputation. We are very, very fortunate to have had them involved with this. And this report contains both that recap and it also contains great recommendation, 12 recommendations on response and 8 recommendations on prevention, which is really where I'd like to spend most of my time thinking about, but also recovery, because if we don't prevent it and we don't respond effectively, we do have to recover from it. I would point to the Hilliard-Hines report that the city of Minneapolis also commissioned that also just came out, because if you want to know what Minneapolis was doing, you really need to look at that report, because the focus that we asked Wilder to take was to take a look at what the state was doing. But the two in combination should help you get a more holistic picture. But the reality was courthouse in Dakota County was firebombed during this. We had the Midway area of St. Paul was torched and looted during this. We had banks that were robbed and immigrants' businesses that were looted. And we had pharmacies that had their entire stock of OxyContin wiped out during this. So there are more reports beyond this one and Minneapolis's, I think, if we're really to get a complete picture, but this, we hope, gives you a start to that. And with that, I will be cede whatever time I have left to answer questions or to respond.
Very well, there's a lot here, and unfortunately we're not gonna have time to do the lot, but we'll see if we can find other time later in the session to continue this conversation. But for now, let me just jump into a couple of the questioners. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here, and thank you, folks from Wilder, for your presentation today. Commissioner Harrington, I just want to thank you for taking this opportunity to and being willing to examine your agency to identify any shortcomings. As you know, I've been requesting this report since last year. And I read in the letter that you provided today that the publication of this report was postponed based on concerns about Wilder's ability to communicate or speak with community. Now, there's also been some speculation from members of community that this report was delayed or heavily edited to avoid embarrassment and or ability to act on these recommendations. Now, I don't know if that's true. I think we talk pretty frequently. We have a good relationship. But what I want to do is make sure that we can work to dispel those allegations. So I'd like to have access to any prior report materials. And with that said, would you be willing to give us any materials that are public, according to our data practices law, of any reports that were provided prior by Wilder so that we can make sure we can review those to dispel any of these allegations that may be out there?
Mr. Harrington.
Representative Frazier, I'm happy to work with you on this. I think we also need to make sure that Wilder is comfortable with earlier drafts and things along that lines being shared. But I'm happy to, to work with you on that. I can tell you that, in the earliest draft of the report, there were several places where Wilder made note that they had been unable to meet with the Somali community or the Little Earth community, and they needed more time to do that. That was where the additional time was granted, and we paid for the additional time, but we thought that was the right thing to do. If we're going to have a comprehensive report, that made the most sense to me. So I'm happy to join you. I will also say that Wilder has offered to go back to the communities that they did focus groups with, and DPS has offered and is more than willing to go out and meet with those groups face-to-face to also talk to them about their concerns, so that this is the beginning, not the end of the conversation.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioner. And to I appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to working with you and with Wilder on this as we move forward. To the extent that there's any type of non-disclosure agreements, I want to make sure that we're going to be okay with you, with the department, releasing Wilder from those any of those obligations. Will we be okay with that?
Commissioner.
You're asking me a legal question, and I'm not the general counsel. I will agree in principle, but I will have to consult with my counsel before I can make a definitive statement on that. So, but in principle, I don't have any problem with that at all.
Representative Frazier.
That's fair enough, Commissioner. I, as a lawyer, I can appreciate that. I would hope that you'd circle back with counsel before answering. Thank you. My second question, I noticed I also requested, let me get to some of the facts, right? On pages 3 and 4 of the report, Wilder notes several areas for improvement. And some of these I would suggest is probably overly polite in the way that they framed them, but it's their report, and I think that's fine. Standards promoting accountability were not consistently followed among participating law enforcement agencies. On several occasions, law enforcement did not successfully differentiate between lawful and unlawful protesters. Jaleel Stallings comes to mind. Also, law enforcement allegedly unlawfully detained, arrested, or inappropriately used crowd dispersal methods on journalists. Now, I think these seem kind of understated given the well-documented treatment that journalists, peaceful protesters, and innocent bystanders were subject to by some officers, including most notably, as I mentioned earlier, Jaleel Stallings. Now, as you know, my office requested every discipline action the department has taken related to this report. I understand that there were zero. Is there any way that you can kind of reconcile this lack of accountability with the findings in this report?
Commissioner Harrington.
Representative Frazier. As my understanding is, we've had 6 internal affairs complaints that we've received, 4 which received during the period that Wilder was doing the report, of which I believe 1 had been disciplined. The other 3, in some cases, were issues of identification of what agency the officer worked for, which we then corrected by making sure that State Patrol and DNR officers had very clear and very visible identification on their mobile field force uniforms, so that in the future, if there were cases like this, that we'd be able to identify our officers from other officers from every other jurisdiction. So we have also, as part of the 21CP and the most recently settlement through the ACLU, agreed to have an outside review of all our internal affairs cases. So that is on tap to proceed. And we have also already begun rewriting our standard operating procedures from the State Patrol, and have also engaged with a media trainer who will train all of the State Patrol with media so that we are all on the same page moving forward. So those things were done not directly related to the Wilder report, but were related to more of the Brooklyn Center incidents where we had a complaint that was lodged there that ultimately resulted in us having that settlement that we've discussed.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm glad you kind of went into what I was going to ask next about things that you might put in place to ensure this doesn't happen again. So thank you for doing that work. Chair, I got a couple more questions, so let me know how I'm doing on time. If you need to cut me off, push me and I'll go a little bit faster.
Yeah, I am going to need to get to the others, so why don't you do one more, and then if there's time, I'll circle back. But
Okay, I'll do one more. Hard to pick, because I think both of these questions are pretty good. Let me shift to Commissioner. I know that now that the State Patrol, they have the HEAT program. And I understand that the State Patrol is now conducting heightened traffic enforcement on the 94 corridor between North Minneapolis and Brooklyn Center for the purposes of traffic safety. This area is the most densely populated Black area of the state. Now, as you know, I'm the author of the Pretextual Stop Bill, along with Kelly Moeller and other representatives in the House. And I firmly believe that traffic stops should be reserved for moving violations or equipment malfunctions that endanger drivers. I was shocked to learn when I asked for some of the data on the HEAT program and received it that about 15% of the stops performed by State Patrol were not related to moving violations. Now, while I understand that most of these stops are related to seatbelts, I find it problematic that heightened enforcement in Black communities are being sold as targeting speeders or targeting folks, but they're only targeting folks for seatbelts. Now, I understand that the Office of Traffic Safety and other municipalities are capable of collecting data on the race of those who are stopped or cited. So my question for you is, does DPS collect any data on the racial impact of the HEAT program?
Yes, sir.
Representative Frazier, we actually have talked about the need for having a way to identify race data so that we could do exactly what you articulated. But that process has not been implemented or passed into law. So there isn't any simple way of doing that, giving you the race data. I will say that in looking at the HEAT process, which I believe is actually in Woodbury, because that was where the next request, we were getting requests for all over the state for this, because all over the state, we saw speeding as the cause of death for over 500 Minnesotans last year. And that corridor that you mentioned is one of those areas with high levels of speed. And we saw extremely high levels of speed that we caught people at during the HEAT process, during that first HEAT event. But we are moving it all over the state. As I said, I think the last place I saw it was in Woodbury, but we were also going to Greater Minnesota. So it is not targeting any one community. It is targeting where the crashes and where the speeds and where the moving violations really drive us. And some of those non-moving violations were things that I think you would think that a state patrol officer should stop somebody. If a sheet of plywood falls out of the back of a truck and you pull them over and the person's drunk, I don't call that a pretext stop. I think that's a legitimate stop and a good arrest, that getting a drunk driver off the road at that point.
Well, and I do note Representative Frazier on page 78 of the report, and this is to Ms. Granius, that Wilder makes a pretty big effort by virtue of putting it in a text box that stands out for the rest of the text and in a blue highlighted bolded way, that further research and evaluation are necessary to understand the role of racism in law enforcement responses to civil unrest and determine additional steps to address community distrust in law enforcement and state government. Very difficult to, I would submit, to understand what that role is unless we have data that informs us of, at the very least, the perceptions that may be at play in the actions of those providing for law enforcement. Ms. Granius, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it sure sounds like that's a pretty important point that the Wilder research report wanted to at least put forward before us.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Yes, I would say so. And that came loud and clear from community members and business owners. So, yep, you got it right.
Very well.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Commissioner.
I'm sorry to interrupt, sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
We are absolutely in agreement with that. That is part of why we think, you know, many of the proposals we've had about unconscious bias and implicit bias and training that we want to do, but in addition to that, character-based hiring and hiring people who do not exhibit a history of that kind of prejudice, I think is an important component of how we recruit and maintain both the current cadre of officers we have and the future cadres that we need to hire to be able to meet the needs of the community.
Much more to say on this, but let me push on. I apologize to you, Representative Frazier. Representative Huat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, testifiers, today. And real quick, Commissioner Harrington, it said a lot, especially with our similar backgrounds, that in 40 years, you never seen or saw anything like this before in your career. And I know you've been through a lot. We've been at scenes together. We've been at multiple casualties together. But this tops it, probably tops it for over the country. So that does tell me a lot. But what I'm more curious about is the report here again, and what you were talking about today is the NCIS training. I know that I've received it. I know three other members of this committee have received the training. It just is what you do is if you're in police, fire, or EMS. And so it surprised me that that system broke down, because that system is like our Bible of how we run a scene. And it's so important that we have to stick to that. What really concerns me here is a statement you made, and I want to make sure I heard it right. Elected officials got in the way of command. Was that right, or was I misled on that?
Commissioner.
I don't think I said that elected officials got in the way of
command. No, it wasn't the commissioner. It was the report.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
There were moments where we were trying to figure out what the mission was, and we got conflicting orders from different elected officials. So I got calls in the middle of the night from members of your body saying the city's burning, what should we do? And then we would call the city officials that are elected officials and say, this is the call we got. And then we'd hear back saying, the city wasn't answering the phones or whatever was going on, or the 911 system was jammed up and people couldn't respond. And so it became, we were trying to facilitate the conversation between elected officials. And ultimately what we ended up doing was having more unified briefings of elected officials to say, let's all be on the same page. Let's know each and other's mission. And then let's have one mission or just a few missions that we can actually meet. So I think that would probably be accurate. But there were certainly elected officials who had very definite opinions about how to stop the problem, some of which did not fit within either the ICS or within good policing practices.
Mr. Chair, real quick, and then I'll be done.
So
to hear this, it's disturbing because you're in a command situation, and nowhere in NCIS do elected officials play a role in that command other than to bring the checkbook. I mean, if I remember right, their job is to consult you as commander or whoever your command is, and they basically have it there, because you don't turn the helm of the ship over to the owner when it's going towards the shore. You get the best pilots you have. So I'm a little concerned about this. I think I can see where we had a command structure breakdown. So. And again, I don't think it was the guys on the ground. I think we have to own part of this as elected officials. So thank you, Chief Harrington, and thank you for the report.
Wise observation. Thank you, Representative Hugh. Chair Dabney.
Chair Mariani, thank you. And again, thank you for inviting me to the table today. My question, I think, is for Ms. Granius. And first, thank you for the report. Commissioner Harrington, thank you as well for the report. And thank you, Ms. Granius, for personalizing it. The story you told is, unique to your experience, not different from what many of my constituents experienced in those days in late May and in early June of 2020. I'm trying to square the I want to get it right. Hilliard Hines report on the city of Minneapolis's after action assessment and this report. And so a couple of questions that flow from that. That Hilliard Hines report really is frankly quite damning of the leadership of my city, and but most particularly the leadership of the Minneapolis Police Department at this time. They lacked the policies that were needed to respond. They ignored the policies that they did have when they needed to use them to respond. This flowed down to then line officers on the street and at events who lacked leadership and did not comply with existing policies that they should have, leading to escalatory behavior that did not operate in a way to restore safety, but instead inflame the situation. So questions that flow from that is, did you or your team, Ms. Granius, consult the Hilliard Hines report in the creation of this report?
Ms. Granius? I'm sorry, were you done?
I think I can, for time, just lay out a couple of questions here real quickly, Mr. Chair. Whatever's your preference, sir.
That's probably wise, because I'm going to have to keep moving, but please.
So did you consult that report? Did it influence this report in any way? And then how do you understand your first recommendation about better coordination, understandable and welcome, with when you've got a local player that is not functioning fully up to capacity or need? Thank you, Mr. Chair, again. Thank you, Ms. Granius.
Very well, thank you, Chair Dabney. Ms. Granius and all your team members.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Dabney. To answer your question, no, we did not consult that report. We didn't have access to it at the time. We were finalizing our report in the final stages. We did, however, submit a proposal to conduct the city's review and thought it would be great to do the state and the city's simultaneously. The city didn't select us, the state did. Your second question was?
The influence of the Hilliard report, but
apparently it didn't influence it. We were very curious when it came out to read it. And then the final comment, I think it really comes down to, this was unprecedented really for a local jurisdiction to not be equipped to handle this kind of situation. And so it was all new, it seemed, for the state and the city to be operating in this way. And so I'll just kind of keep coming back to coordination, communication, and relationships. In our review, we found that St. Paul had a little bit of a better time with the National Guard request. And part of that is because they're used to working together to protect the state capitol, manage crowds, protect First Amendment rights on a regular basis. And so they had some systems and relationships in place to just help that flow more efficiently and to contact the right people to know how to ask for help. And it seemed like that relationship wasn't as solid or in place between Minneapolis and the state. So I would just say, yeah, coordination and communication systems weren't ready and primed and prepped for a situation like this. And in the future, they could be.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Ms. Granius. I asked that question simply because my constituents, the public, are going to have to somehow figure out how to square these two reports and trying to find where the connections are so that we can better understand the events of May and June of 2020, but then to your other points, better prepare, and the commissioner's other points, better prepare for when the inevitable occurs unexpectedly again. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. As chair of the Minneapolis delegation and our body, I thought it was really important for you to be here. Thank you for accepting my invitation. It does speak, there's much here. in your question, I think it speaks, among other things, to the capacity that exists and the orientation, preparedness, levels of commitment to best evidence-based practices that exist among all our different units. Otherwise, arguably, you've got units that are interacting with one another. Great that they're coordinating, but if they're not prepared in that way, we shouldn't be perhaps surprised with the outcome. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. So to the author of the report, in there it said that the external review was commissioned by DPS. What was the cost of this report, Mr. Chair?
Ms. Gradius and or Commissioner Harrington.
I don't have the exact number in front of me, but it was originally $150,000, and then we did an amendment to do an additional about $30,000 to conduct more data collection and work with a law enforcement expert that we worked with. So in total, $180,000.
Very well, thank you.
I could get you an exact number if you want.
I appreciate that. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So ICS 300 and 400 is the basic, unified command training that those of us that are in ICS go through. Can the commissioner describe the rotation schedule that was used for leadership to go through the advanced courses, the 300, 400 level, prior to the riots? And then what's changed as far as leadership rotation schedules into that level of advanced training since then? Have we taken steps to do additional leadership training specifically on 300, 400, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Commissioner?
Commissioner Raleigh, I do not have an answer specific to that question. I will check with General Joe Kelly from HSEM. We regularly offer the courses, and I know we regularly have offered those courses every year, for example, at the Emergency Managers Conference that the governor sponsors. But I would have to do a little bit more research to get you an actual leadership rotation on that, and I'm happy to do that.
I'm intrigued by your inquiries, Representative Raleigh. Representative Raleigh, one more, and then we'll move on.
Roger that, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that was Commissioner Harrington stated was, and I didn't find it in the report, and this is for the reason for the question, Mr. Chair, it was stated that there were groups that were placing accelerants or flammables in the neighborhoods. I've not been able to find that in the Wilder research yet, and I'm wondering if the commissioner or if the report author, have there been any groups that have been identified as being responsible for placing these accelerants? And Mr. Chair, this is the first time I've heard of it, so I'm not quite sure how to phrase if these were groups, if these were loosely affiliated. I'm just wondering what the findings were, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, and I did hear of this back then. It's particularly disturbing. Commissioner, perhaps better for you.
Representative Raleigh, Chair, we asked ATF, the Federal Alcohol, Tobaccos, and Firearms, to lead the investigations on that. And I can check with them to see. I know they have made, as I said, I believe well over a dozen arrests on folks that use the flammables to burn down buildings. I know we also coordinated with then Chief Friedel, the Minneapolis Fire Chief, and others to go out and collect the flammables. And we, in fact, posted that through the 311 and the 911 systems in Minneapolis, that individuals who found them should call us so that we could collect them so we could check for fingerprints. I am not aware that any group was identified as being responsible for that.
All right. Very well. Let's find information if we can and forward it to our committee members. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions since I know we have lots of others who want to ask questions as well. My first is for Ms. Grani, is following up on questions from Representative Dabney about the two reports. And so I understand that you didn't read it and did not inform the report that you put forward. I'm curious, though, after having now read it and having released your report, what some of the takeaways are for you that stand out from the Minneapolis report conclusions, and where you see, are there any differences that were notable to you, or do you see reinforcement of some of the points that you made in the state report?
And this is to the
Ms. Granias.
Ms. Granias.
Thank you, Chair and Representative, for your question. We don't feel comfortable talking about the Minneapolis AAR. If you have specific questions about the findings or recommendations from that report that you want to ask about, we can confirm or deny whether we found the same things or have a similar recommendation. I will say, at a very high level, I saw some overlap, and so it was affirming to me reading it, but I don't think I feel able to comment fully on that report, but I'm happy to respond in relation to our specific findings and recommendations if you have a specific question.
Representative Long, and we're going to have to keep moving here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do, but I don't have time today, so I'll follow up with you later. I just have one more question for Commissioner Harrington. You had noted, Commissioner, some of the action steps that the department has taken already in response to the internal review that you all conducted. And I'm just curious if you could lay out with the Wilder report, what are some of the additional steps that the department is planning to take to respond to this report that maybe above what you've done to date.
Commissioner Harrington.
Representative Long, Mr. Chair. We have a fairly long list, and I'll try and keep it fairly short. We have asked for $500,000 to develop that online and in-person training for local elected leaders on FEMA, ICS 300 and 400, because we believe that would facilitate, making sure that everybody's on the same page there. Subsequent to this, we have moved into having, whenever we have state resources at a substantial event, we now have a media PIO go out and a state ombudsman go out so that we can resolve any immediate media issues there. One of the other things that we've done that I think really does speak to sort of the community-based piece of this is that as we were planning for the Chauvin trial and other trials, we created relationships with local community groups and business associations to give them advice and warnings about what we thought might happen, and also to give them an opportunity to tell us, what they need in order to be made to feel safe. That really did work very well. For example, the National Guard sat down with Little Earth over in Minneapolis to talk about how the look of the National Guard could be triggering for individuals who have had trauma from, the South Dakota, North Dakota pipeline disputes and things along that line. So some of those things have already been put into place, training, and there are things in our legislative package around Minnesota HEALS that we think are absolutely part and parcel of a conversation between police and their community to rebuild trust. We really do believe that is a key to reducing deadly force encounters. We believe it's also key to being able to have civil disputes and civil protests, but without the fires and the loss of life and the damage that we saw that happened during this one.
Very well. Members, the chair is incredibly pressed, so we're going to have to leave it at that for now. I know there are still members with questions and or comments. If there's an interest on the part of committee members to have an extension and if you will, of this hearing in future dates, please let me know. It's an important report, and I think we do need to do more than just scratch the surface of it. I do apologize for those still not able to get it. I do want to thank Ms. Granias and her team for the work. Commissioner, there's still plenty of time left for us to consider legislative action. I am a little concerned with Representative Frazier's, the questioning around accountability issues. We do know, the public knows, that there was egregious behavior, and it's just critically important that we have a good, strong accountability system that would hold folks accountable for that going into the future. Certainly want to continue to talk with you about those individuals who may have been involved that are under your jurisdiction.
Thank you for that conversation, sir. So we also would note that you've already funded body cams for all our state troopers. And so as we move into the future, you have already equipped us in a way that will make sure that it will be even easier for us to hold people accountable if, in fact, they take the wrong steps.
Point well taken. Thank you, Commissioner. All right, members. So with that, we're going to move on to informational hearing on House File 4609. This is authored by Chair Moran. There are five testifiers, and that's partly why I'm pushing, because I want to be able to honor their commitment to be with us here today to offer testimony on this important issue. Chair Moran, if you're there, I'd welcome your opening brief comments, and then we'll turn this over to the testifiers to share their learnings and knowledge with us.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to say that was a really good informational hearing. This is a really important issue, too, that is impacting a lot of folks who are trying to re-enter our community and, you know, get off probation. And I just hope we have enough time to do it justice. So House File 4609 is a statewide nonpartisan bill that support policies and funding recommendation proposed by the Governor Council on Justice Reinvestment. House File 4609 is the result of a six-month collaborative effort between state, local, and tribal nation partners to address critical issues in community supervision practices and investment in Minnesota. It represents a compromise and agreement on supervision priorities across party lines, branches of government, counties, tribes, and the state supervision system, treatment providers, and community leaders all involved. It is the result of Minnesotans coming together to identify a solution to these long-standing problems in order to help those on probation be successful and to create a safer community. We must invest in both policies and dollars to achieve better sustainable outcomes for counties across this state. With that, Mr. Chair, I will pass it on to the testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Moran. We have our first testifier, Ms. Catherine Johnson. If you can come forward, state your name for the record. Give us your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Catherine Johnson. I am the Director of Community Corrections in Hennepin County and currently serve as the President of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, otherwise known as MACAC. Joining me today are my colleagues, Alan Godfrey, of the Field Services Director at the Department of Corrections, and Jason Anderson, who is the Probation Director in Itasca County and also the current President of the Minnesota Association of Community Probation Offices, otherwise known as MACPO. You will hear from both Al and Jason shortly. Our organizations, MACAC, the DOC, and MACPO, not only fully support this proposal, we helped write it together collaboratively. This proposal also has the support of the Association of Minnesota Counties, representing all 87 counties in Minnesota. I believe there is the presentation. We are here to present the recommendations included in that Justice Reinvestment Report, a report that was the result of an historic collaboration between state, counties, tribes, and the community supervision delivery systems. These recommendations are also found in House File 4609. They are the result of more than 200 collaborative meetings and more hours than, frankly, I can count. And we are very proud of the results of that work. We are also hopeful about achieving the outcomes that this proposal is pointing us toward. We have a unique system of community supervision in Minnesota that allows for county choice. There are three methods for delivering community supervision that counties can choose from. Those are the Community Corrections Act, those counties that I am representing here today for MACAC, counties utilizing the county probation office model, and my colleague Jason will speak on their behalf today, and the Department of Corrections, and Al Godfrey is joining us, as I mentioned, from the DOC. Each of these delivery system models serves the needs of their individual communities. They each have unique challenges in providing the level of community supervision necessary to keep Minnesotans safe and to keep our clients on successful paths. Though we work together as part of one larger system, the work of community supervision is divided between the counties and the State Department of Corrections. Those county delivery systems supervise approximately 82% of our probation cases, and the remaining are supervised by the Department of Corrections. Counties choose which of the three delivery system models works best for their local community. In some communities, it makes more sense for the state to provide those services, and in others, it does not. This local choice and collaborative model is what makes Minnesota unique. Over the years, these delivery systems have often competed for resources and debated policy changes, but not today. Today, we stand before you united in our message. We all serve the same people, Minnesotans, and we all have the same goals, community safety and client success. Throughout this presentation, you have and will hear me mention and us mention community supervision. This refers to both probation in lieu of prison time or supervised release, which occurs after a prison sentence. The focus on the use of community supervision as the preferred alternative in Minnesota has been based on clear evidence that people are less likely to commit future crimes when they receive the right services in community, and that ultimately protects the public from further victimization. This focus on community supervision means that Minnesota is a low incarceration state. Although crime has risen over recent years, it has not risen to the level of many other states, including those with high incarceration rates. Yet Minnesota spends the lowest percentage of general fund dollars in the country on corrections. I am fortunate to have the opportunity to teach about criminal justice as an adjunct instructor, and I often use an analogy to help my students better understand the way in which our justice system works. I equate it to being like a house, with law enforcement being the front door, prosecutors, judges, and defense attorneys occupying different rooms inside that house, and corrections serving as the exit or back door. We are last in the entire country on corrections funding. The back door in Minnesota is falling off the hinges. This is a problem that contributes to high caseloads and less effective community supervision. Chairman Yanni and members, will now pass the mic to my colleague from the Department of Corrections, Al Godfrey, who's going to elaborate on why this level of underfunding creates significant issues.
Thank you, Ms. Jassen. And just in case I forget to do this, because I might, I just want to acknowledge and thank you for the many years of work that you've provided to obviously people in Hennepin County, but the state of Minnesota on this important issue. Next, we have Alan Godfrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Al Godfrey. I'm the Field Services Director for the Minnesota Department of Corrections and a former Community Corrections Act Director. I've had the benefit of managing supervision from both the state and county perspective. As CJ has indicated, the DOC along with CPO and CCA is fully engaged and supportive of this initiative. In my role as DOC Field Services Director, I manage 270 staff at the department who provide direct supervision services similar to the county staff that work within CCA and CPO. Here at the DOC, we have seen these inequities caused by our current system and the disparate outcomes that result based on how a county or the DOC is resourced and supported in providing supervision. The way the state funds supervision across the three systems is convoluted, difficult to follow, and part of the problem. The legislature has all but bound to appropriate adequate funding for incarceration in our state prisons. Those costs are calculated and made clear each biennium. But funding for supervision for all three delivery systems is carried in the DOC's budget as a subsidy. It's not adjusted automatically nor funded based on data about how much it actually costs to supervise an individual in the community. And over the years, it has been a common theme for that funding not to keep up with need. Under Minnesota State Statute 244.19, it requires 50% felony levels for CPO counties, and prorated appropriation does not meet that financial requirement. Appropriation has not met the 50% requirement for many years. This is why a formula is so desperately needed and supported by the DOC, CPO, and CCA. Ensuring that each county or agency has the right level of resources to adequately and effectively provide evidence-based supervision. This graph illustrates how the probation was how this graph illustrates how the problem was created and exacerbated over time. It shows the effect on the budget of real county who is part of CCA. The green line in the middle shows a gradual decline in the percentage of state funding for supervision, funding that is relied upon by the county. To make up for this loss and to keep communities safe, the county then had to raise its property tax levy to make up the difference. Thus, the increase in county spending indicated by the blue line at the top. Each system of supervision has experienced shortfalls and had to scrape together what resources they can, including relying on client fees to provide at least adequate level of supervisions. While counties have experienced shortfalls of funding, this has also been an issue for DOC field supervision. Over the last two decades, the Minnesota Department of Corrections only received funding for 1 year to add a small number of additional felony agents, which is well short of caseload demands. But we shouldn't want an adequate level of community supervision. We should want the best, evidence-based, and well-resourced system possible. When counties in the DOC have had to make these difficult budget decisions, regardless of the supervision system they are in, the level of service is impacted. As CJA has indicated, supervision agents often have very large caseloads and cannot provide individualized or specialized services. The kind of services that we know is effective and often lead to successful outcomes that are expected by both the persons we serve and our communities we help keep safe. Members, we have a short video to show you that demonstrate what successful supervision can look like when a county has the resources to help thrive and help in their communities do better.
The United States incarcerates significantly more people than any other industrialized nation in the world. And our historic get tough on crime policies haven't had the desired outcome. Over the course of the last 20 years, we've been equipped with a significant amount of research that tells us both what works and what doesn't with the clients that we serve. As a result of that research, we have an obligation to change our approach. And that approach includes both the interventions we offer our clients and the way we interact with our clients. At DFO Community Corrections, we're committed to that obligation. And we're seeing a difference. We interviewed both clients and probation officers to gather their perspective in regards to the work that we do and the change in our approach.
It's not just a client and probation officer. I am a support person, sometimes like a little bit of a therapist.
She really wanted to get to know me, my story, versus kind of just coming in and going over like, oh, this is what you need to do. I had a different agent before who's great, but it was kind of more of the, you know, cut and dry, like here's the things that you need to check off.
I am here to help her, and that offer, I want to offer those services that we have, and I want her to be successful.
Giving us choices rather than, you know, telling us what we have to do. She's asked questions about my life versus just not bothering to get to know me, kind of wanting to know about my family history, you know, because ultimately that's kind of the stuff that makes us tick, the reasons that we use.
She didn't probably have the best upbringing with a female role model, so I can partake in a little bit of that role modeling relationship also.
She knows my ins and outs. She's there if I need to call her.
We are now allowing to develop that relationship with the client where their honesty is going to come through, that they want to tell us the truth that they're struggling with their addictions, and maybe do some cognitive reports with them in the office versus always having to have a detention or a lockup or a jail consequence.
Just honesty has been going a long way. They're not just throwing us in jail anymore, kind of giving us, you know, choices to make. I'm still compassionate. I'm empathetic. I'm sympathetic. I feel for these women on my caseload that continue to struggle every day of their lives with success, addiction, relationships. And where I come from, the idea of with my client is mainly the idea of empowering the positive qualities for them, giving them positive feedback versus coming down hard on them for things that they struggle with it, mental health and chemical dependency.
I have a whole team of people working for me versus just the probation.
I feel it's very necessary to involve as many resources as possible for my client. I put it in the idea of being making sure that their structure and their plate is full when it comes to these resources, whether it be holistic, religious, spiritual, physical health. It's not always where you came from, it's where you're going to keep going to, and that'll better serve you and better make you successful as well.
Like now going to meet your PO, I'm not nervous to come talk to her. It's more of a just like this, just talking with somebody versus I'm scared, like my life is in her hands. No, I have choices and I dictate my future.
And I truly enjoy the relationships, getting to know, you know, I get to know them, what, like I said, motivates them, what are they doing, what are their goals. You know, I get to hear about not just, you know, the mistakes and the things that, you know, the roadblocks and challenges, I get to hear about when they succeed.
How you guys look at not just taking the criminal aspect of us into consideration, throwing the book at us. You guys look at us as like humans, you know.
Each relationship is different and each client has different motivators. And I feel like that's really important.
He's been really understanding.
Well, I'm going to give you the keys here, and you're going to be the person driving. I'm going to be in the passenger seat, but if I see that you're going to drive a little reckless, or if I see you're going to drive off a cliff, I will ask you to pull over, and I might have to drive for a little bit.
You broke this, we know what your consequence is. You know, my first violation, I know how much time I'd have to go sit. It's a fact that I know that that's already in place. So that pushes me motivation to be like, all right, well, I don't want to go sit that much time in county.
You know, you're able to actually help with other parts of your life instead of just the criminal part.
I didn't have a fear to come and meet with my PO today, and that was cool. That was way cool.
I personally have seen what doesn't work because I've done that with my clients. And when I did that, I had no relationship. They didn't trust me. They ran away from me. And here they come to me when they're in a crisis.
I don't like to open up to very many people. So the fact that she's allowed me to, one, gain her trust and for her to gain mine is actually kind of, it's a new concept, I guess.
Our ability to utilize cognitive behavioral interventions in our office visits have really opened up the doors to communication. I feel like I've just gained a really good relationship with my clients.
Before, it used to be POs and the system locked you up. That was it. You know, so we learned to lie.
We really put the burden of change on our clients, and we're just a tool that they utilize for resources and getting them from point A to point B.
This is the only office in my whole life I've been on probation and parole that honesty was a big factor.
We are 100% here for our clients.
I went to my PO and she's like, what's going on? And I says, I'm doing the deal, I need help. And she said, okay, I'm not gonna lock you up. You're gonna take the steps. You're gonna get the help. She goes, I will put in just as much effort as you do.
It's not about the relapse that leads to incarceration or any sort of sanction. It's not showing up to me, it's not being honest with me.
They care. They really care. Even the people that lie to them and try to manipulate them, they still care because they understand. They're starting to understand the criminal behavior and the addicts, that we don't do it because we're mean people or terrible people. We do it because we suffer. And that's all we've ever known. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will now pass this on the baton back to my colleague with the CPO, Jason Anderson.
Very well. Members, we do have some extra time. Our staff has been communicating with IT and they've been wonderful, but we are going to have to keep pushing very tightly. Mr. Anderson, please come forward.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and appreciate the opportunity to speak to you guys this afternoon. Watching that video just reminds me, I've worked in the field of corrections for about 24 years, and when people learn that I'm affiliated with probation, oftentimes people kind of go, oh, it's got to be tough work, man, it's got to be. But seeing these examples, this is how fulfilling the work can be. So that was just really energizing for me. I am honored and humbled to be before you today to speak, and especially to speak alongside of Mr. Godfrey with the Department of Corrections and Ms. Johnson with the Hennepin County and the Community Corrections Act folks. This is a pretty remarkable thing that the three delivery systems are standing shoulder to shoulder here virtually in support of this. The omnibus bill that was passed last year by the legislature tasked us with this work. And we'll unpack that just briefly about how we came upon these recommendations. But I would think as legislators, you're often maybe frustrated by the fact that entities and agencies and individuals come to you with problems and say, fix this. This is underfunded. This is broken. We need help. We fix, reform, resolve. I hope it's refreshing that we're coming to you saying we've got some great ideas of what can be done. And we've really puzzled over this. We've really worked hard over this to make this happen. I think we've lost our slides, but I'm more than happy to just chat freestyle. So how did this come together? The collaboration by Minnesota supervision experts. So as I said, last year's omnibus passed legislation that said, we're going to convene the justice reinvestment. Ooh, there we go. We're going to throw together some groups, right? And so we had a subject matter expert group, a work group. We met a ton of times. We're going to go with, is that the right slide? Next slide, please. No, that's good. So we had 244 meetings were conducted across this state of Minnesota to have conversations about this, to puzzle over this, to work collaboratively. We had the Governor's Council on Justice Reinvestment, which included Representative Novotny, Representative Moran. Thank you for your contributions and your leaderships in those roles. Included tribal leadership. Criminal justice stakeholders, law enforcement, the courts. It was a very broad cross-section that arrived upon these recommendations. And what are these recommendations? So they really fall into three buckets. The first is to create supervision standards made up of key subject matter experts, representatives from the three delivery systems and others to guide a future funding formula. At issue here isn't simply, oh, we're underfunded. Boy, are we. And that's been articulated already in this presentation. Mr. Godfrey referenced that the CPO model, by statute, we're supposed to receive 50% reimbursement to our staff's salary and fringe. It's been 26 years since that has occurred. That's 1996 is the last time that has occurred. This isn't just it's been tough these last few years. We've come through a number of administrations and a number of budget surpluses and deficits and highs and lows, and we've been woefully underfunded. Money alone is not the issue, though. It's how the funding is delivered, whether it's equitable across the state and whether it's adequate. So three recommendations. Number one, create a specific task force to identify a better model. Identify permanent transparent funding so that it's predictable. We know what's coming. We know how it's getting. And no longer are the three delivery systems each kind of vying for their slice of the pie. Rather, we stand like we are today, shoulder to shoulder, saying community supervision needs to be adequately funded. And then lastly, another significant component to this was to be able to add state and federally recognized tribes as viable entities to engage in their own community supervision. That's been long past due and is contemplated in these recommendations. So how do we make this happen?
Mr. Anderson, I'm gonna give you 30 seconds. I apologize.
Okay, all right.
We share the three recommendations and then I do wanna.
Yep, so three steps. Number one, this first year, we need more money. How we get there, that's in the bill. I won't drill down into that. Secondly, We task a work group to establish the capitated rate, which would be a funding formula that funds agencies based on the risk level of the clients they serve. And then step three, put this into practice. So lastly, I just want to end with this. The outcomes that we seek, the outcomes that are the best outcomes for the victims, for the communities, for the state of Minnesota, for our agencies, are not mutually exclusive outcomes. We are all shooting for the same thing. How do we get there? Adequately and equitably fund community supervision. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you much so much, committee members. We welcome any and all questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And members, you know, these individuals have brought forward your work. It was your actions last year that set them on the path, the expectation of bringing back a better way for us to provide these services, critical services in our state. We know that there are lots of things that are not working well, and we have a way to have them work well. And so I do want to acknowledge the historic opportunity here, particularly with three systems coming forward together with a very thoughtful approach that has policy at the center of it, not just money. We often hear from lots of folks, give me more money, you know, and there's definitely a case for strong, better resources. You heard part of that, but also making sure that we're not just putting more money into a increasingly failing system, but into, in fact, an effective system. And we've got terrific individuals who people that system with heart and soul and thought. And so there's so much good that we can be doing here. I'm going to ask Ms. Mitchell to come forward super briefly. Then we have Mr. Bruce, and then we'll see how we're doing with time. I do want to be able to get Representative Otney's quick thoughts here, because he spent a lot of time serving on this body, on this task force, rather. Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I'm Kelly Mitchell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota. I also served as a member of the Governor's Justice Reinvestment Council. And I'm really here today just to actually add an exclamation point to the point that you just made. I do think that shoring up the funding, changing the funding formula, having this weighted caseload study is incredibly critical to supporting community supervision going forward. But I also think that the policy is important. Representative Moran's bill includes a policy standards committee, a place that would create a table for all three delivery systems to continue to come together and work on policy to help improve our system. One statistic that wasn't brought forward today is that 60% of our prison admissions are from supervision failures. And that is in part because the system is underfunded, and it's also in part because we need to move policy forward and make sure that we're using evidence-based practices, we're following the research on what works in supervision. So I really urge this group to think on both planes. It should be a both and as we move forward, both funding and policy. And I thank you for allowing me to make that point today, Representative Mariani.
Critically important point. Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We're a union representing more than 15,000 professionals, including DOC community supervision agents and felony level supervision agents in CPO counties. House File 4609 takes a huge qualitative comprehensive step to address historic funding deficiencies for all three community supervision systems and to do it equitably. However, we do have a couple concerns. The first is MAPE is concerned with the funding formula for fiscal years 24 and 5 and its potential impact on agents serving in those CPO counties. The combined effect of both removing the minimum population requirements to form a CCA jurisdiction and the weight given to risk levels in the funding formula could act as a disincentive for CPO counties to continue under that delivery system, providing felony level supervision may increase the grant subsidy amount pretty substantially. This concern is mostly for our agents because DOC agents transitioning to counties do not have the same guarantees of salary, benefit, or seniority protections that county agents transitioning to DOC are provided. Second, we're concerned about the reforms on the CPO reimbursement may impact our bargaining process. Even if we negotiate our salary settlements well within the legislative appropriations, the DOC could be forced to withhold some of the money and leave positions vacant to ensure that they are able to cover the county's share of the costs. This would exacerbate current staffing issues and quality of supervision and impacts our ability to negotiate contracts in good faith with M&B. Unlike the counties, DOC cannot access any other funding streams beyond the general fund appropriations by the legislature to cover the cost of supervision. We do plan on meeting with the county partners early next week and the bill author to find some resolution for those points or whenever this comes up next. And we thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. I look forward to seeing what the product of that conversation would be, and we'll take the, those seriously if they come forward. You know, only a system is only as good as its people and the quality and the preparedness and the commitment of the people that people those systems. And you represent, you know, some of the best folks, I believe, in our state doing a lot of heavy lifting and important work. Representative Ivan, you were a member of the task force, and so I just want to call on you before we run out of time here to see if you want to issue any thoughts, advice, comments relative to this work and this request. And perhaps Representative Rodney might not be here. Lee Johnson, I'll offer you that role, and then I'm going to call on Chair Moran to close us out.
Chair Mariani, actually, I had my hand up for the other bill.
Yes, you did.
I'm really disappointed I didn't get to talk on that. That's in a, or the other information. That was a lot of information that we were discussing on that, which is very important, not only to the citizens of Minneapolis, but the citizens across this state. Being forced not, we had four, I had four, three members waiting to talk on that bill, but we were shut down again.
Lee Johnson, you had two members I called on to talk on that bill. I made it real clear that I was not going to be able to get to everyone. The bill before us right now is Representative Moran.
We had a 129-page report that we received 2 hours ago. And to have it
Lee Johnson,
2 hours before session.
Lee Johnson to Representative Moran's bill.
You know, I've been spending most of my time trying to go through the report dealing with the riots in Minneapolis.
So you don't have any questions on Representative Moran's bill then? Very well. Chair Moran, if you can close this out, then we'll adjourn this committee because we only have like a minute left.
Chair Mariana, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill before the committee. And, you know, this is a definitely a bipartisan bill. And I'm just going to repeat how I ended before by saying, in order to help those on probation be successful and to create safer communities, we must invest in both policies and dollars to achieve better sustainable outcomes for counties and individuals who are on probation across the state. And this is a bill that looks at both. So I just want to say thank you for your time and thank the members for hearing this bill.
And I thank you for your time, Chair Moran, on this task force, as well as Representative Novotny. This is really important work. We will be back on this issue as we mark up our bill, omnibus bill, next week, and hopefully that will provide more opportunities for questions and comments and of course, action. So thank you, Chair Moran. Members, with that, we will convene again tomorrow at our regular scheduled time. A reminder to members that the chair intends to post our draft for our omnibus bill that we will then spend many hours next week debating and amending and shaping. And so, members, until tomorrow morning, this committee stands adjourned.